In September of next year, we launch the second curriculum, which is a web-based curriculum from K to 12. And then in the spring of 2011, there will be a curatorial conference that will invite 150 young curators from around the world to Vancouver in discussion about art in public space. We conclude in April, May of 2011 with a gala week, life auction, which is co-sponsored by Christie's, our major sponsor. And that's how we differ from most biennales in the sense that we generate our income to create legacies for the City of Vancouver and region through sales of the artwork, which are controlled and under reserve by these famous artists. The artists that are participating have been selected by six major curators, huge names in the Asian world, and a couple of young curators from the Western world. So I hope you'll take the opportunity to, over the next many, many, many months, get out and about, and whether it's from downtown Vancouver or along the New Canada Line to the airport or into Richmond, that you will explore the amazing installations that will spring up. So just a few thank yous. I want to thank Roberta Kramer, who has been responsible for our programs and for tomorrow's event and the lecture series. There'll be a series of lectures throughout the next 22 months. Jillian Ward, who is our liaison and the person who ensures that I actually get to where I'm going and make sure things happen. I also want to thank David Watson, who's made this possible, who made the connection with Charles Jenks and through the Vancouver Institute. I want to thank the Vancouver Institute, John Grace, and Quentin Kroc, who's going to do the introduction. And particularly Peter, who has been amazing in terms of just executing things in a very timely and quick manner, unlike anything else that's occurred in the Biennale's movements. So with that said, thank you again. We enjoy the partnership. We enjoyed the partnership with Simon Fraser the other night, and the Biennale is about community partnerships. So keep your eyes peeled and look for the word Vancouver Biennale. Thank you.
Now to introduce our speaker. Our speaker, Charles Jenks, is a major figure. He was trained and studied in English literature and in architecture at Harvard, did a PhD in architectural history at Oxford. He's become one of the world's most influential architectural theorists, also a landscape architect, designer. He's also a furniture designer, a sculptor, author of numerous best-selling books, including The Language of Modern, Postmodern Architecture, a book in which he extended the term postmodernism to the visual arts and to architecture, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation, which is going to be the subject of tonight's talk, the most recent book, The Iconic Building. He's lectured at many universities around the world. With his late wife, he was the founder of Maggie's Caring Cancer Centers, a series of buildings and grounds in various cities, built in the belief that architecture and form can provide healing and comfort to those battling cancer. This is his first time as a public lecturer in Vancouver, and I would like to welcome Professor Jenks very sincerely.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be in a city which is also the country itself, countryside, to come to Vancouver. And I'd like to thank Barry and people of the Vancouver Biennale, I was going to say the Venice Biennale, and Vancouver Institute. I was a professor down in Los Angeles, and we had a similar kind of institute, which met at this time of night, and I enjoyed lecturing to people who would talk back. So I invite you to almost interrupt me during the talk, but I'll be speaking for about an hour and 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll have questions afterward. I'll be speaking, as just mentioned, on the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, but I wanted, and some of my work, not much of it, but a little bit of it, to give you an idea of the kind of content-driven design in landscape I do. But I am tonight going to connect that up with some of the other concerns from architecture and my experience in architecture. And if we could have the lights down maybe so you could see the slides better. I don't know if that's possible to turn down the lights. Great. And in the front even a little bit. Thank you. So I thought I'd get into the subject of what I'm going to call cosmogenic design, or design with respect to the universe, by showing one of the crises of architecture, which has perennial crises, with the iconic building, a great building, one of the probably the greatest skyscraper in Britain, recently constructed, designed in the 90s, but built in the year 2003 by Norman Foster, Lord Foster, building in the center of a historic city. That means the economic powerhouse of a global center of finance. Took over from New York, actually, as the global center for a few years, and now it's dropped back again. In any case, right in the heart of the downtown, you can see next to a 13th and 14th century church and classical background, Foster has designed what was at first a rather small egg-shaped building. In fact, he used an egg as the metaphor for the design. And then, as he expanded the design, the design became this shape, a spiral, with a series of spiral sky courts up the side here, you can see in dark, culminating on a top dome. This building caused a great controversy because it was so beautiful, on the one hand, that it competed with the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral, which has been, you know, the center of British culture for several centuries, and the center of London, and has view corridors dedicated to it, just as you have view corridors in Vancouver for the mountains. And the Dean of St. Paul's objected and said, what is this secular dome doing in the heart of our city? It was the most ecologically correct skyscraper of its time, and remains that to a certain extent. And it had an extraordinary image made out of these triangular-shaped prefabricated glass and other steel elements running up the spirals. All in all, it was building at the cutting edge and a new image, and indeed the iconic building of Britain. At the base, you can see it there, how you enter through that kind of swelling, egg-shaped missile, and how Foster has worked that out quite beautifully. So it became an instant success. People loved it. It had certain problems of inhabitation, because coming after 9/11, people didn't want to move into the most iconic building in the world. But the taxi drivers of London, who control, of course, the metaphors of what new buildings should be called, called it the Gherkin. And so in this collage, I showed what a pickle or a gherkin looks like. To bring out the fact, there's one of the sky courts, by the way, on the on your left, I guess. It's actually, you've got a double slide here, I can see. You can see the metaphor, and you can see that actually it doesn't look at all like a gherkin or pickle. But that name caught on and is stuck in spite of the unlikeliness of it. Perhaps for the reasons that Oscar Wilde said, you know, never call a spade a spade. And everybody knew what the real metaphor was, but they couldn't mention it, the unmentionable. So it is a gherkin, officially. And I put it on the cover. I went through 9 different covers of a book called The Iconic Building. And you can see some of the drawings that I worked out with Madeleine Riesendorf, who I often draw with, and her decoding of the implicit metaphors. And my argument in the book, The Iconic Building, is that in the era of branded one-liners, that the most effective ones are the ones that relate to the different functions and the possible latent meanings that are appropriate to what you want to communicate. And I made the point, and you can see in this version of the book's cover, that, by the way, it wasn't accepted by the publisher, because when they tried it out on the public, they found that the book's sellers put it under military hardware. So it was rejected. Anyway, I rather like it as an iconic cover, but didn't make it through the tests. You can see, I made the point, you can see the subtitle is The Power of Paranoia. Power of Paranoia, because a really powerful, iconic building has to be slightly resistant and disagreeable and have an edge, as I argue in this book, like the Eiffel Tower, which was the most sincerely hated building in Paris, you know, when it was put up in 1889, celebrating 100 years of French Revolution. And it was vilified. There was a committee of 300 most important people of Paris who fought it every meter of the way. It's 300 meters high, and tried to stop it. All the great poets, all the great writers, all the great sculptors, artists, everybody was against it. And they criticized it, you know, as an assault on Paris culture. And they used the ultimate insult. They said, it's Americanization of Paris. This was before the American in Paris. Anyway, you know what happened with the Eiffel Tower. By 1900, it had been accepted. By 1905, it had no function, by the way, for the longest time, except to see the German army invading. It was a high point. But it really was a building without function, designed by the great Eiffel engineer. Anyway, by 1905, it was popular. By 1910, it became the symbol of modernism in many paintings. By 1915, it became a symbol of Paris, and now, in a way, it's the symbol of France. And that is an important route traveled by icons that have an edge which of resistance, slightly paranoid. So you can see in this analysis the missile in the top, and the screw, and the bullet, and the bomb. And below that, the unmentionable, the brain, the finger, the image which I analyzed it as, and I still do, a Fibonacci pine cone, because the spirals that spiral up in a pine cone, a pineapple, and a lot of edible plants have those amazing ratios of the Fibonacci series. So nature has this code. Norman Foster didn't know about that, but in a way, the building has it. So I said it's a positive, iconic building because it's been a mixed metaphor. But I regretted the fact that he hadn't done what I think architecture as a public art should do, and that is to work through the metaphors and be responsible for them. And so I say all that because tonight's talk is my argument that in a period of fast change, a global culture where religion is in decline and people are confused about common meanings, what are you going to symbolize in your buildings, your landscape, in art? What are you going to pay when you pay the great costs of a building such as this gherkin? What are you paying for? Why have a gherkin? Why pay extra millions for that metaphor? It should be a negotiation, partly, between the public, the client, the owner, the users, and others. And if that's so, then what is architecture to be about? What is landscape to be about? And tonight's talk is that in our period of history, when we know things about the universe that have never been known before, and we know something about our relationship to it, the universe is a single, unfolding, creative event that has got a 13.7 billion year history, and we can tell that narrative back to the beginning. This furnishes an iconography for our icons. It's That's the basic idea of tonight's talk. Whether we as creators and artists and architects can use in our art elements that can communicate, sometimes unconsciously and sometimes responsibly consciously, with a public in an enjoyable and sensitive and sensual way. Because I think that was what art has been in the past, certainly in more subtle periods, and it was when this 14th century Bible, French Bible, moralized Bible, with the portrayal of Christ, of God, in color, in vital Gothic color, was using the metaphor which Plato had originated, perhaps, in the, he may have been the originator, because probably it goes back to the Egyptians, Imhotep, the architect of the with the pharaoh, thought to be immortal. The notion that design and architecture and building, craftsmanship, is to build the universe. And so God is shown here with an architectural instrument in his hand. And the metaphor was very real throughout Christian, Judeo-Christian culture and Greek culture, and survives today in a kind of watered-down form in the sense that architects love to be thought of as gods today. In any case, you see him, very much a male god, laying out the universe, earth, air, water, and fire, the four elements. You can actually see the water there. You can make out the sun and the moon and the firmament and the chaotic waters. It's interesting that, in a sense, chaos theory before its time is inherent in the biblical description and in some of this art, because it was ordering the universe, which is out of chaos, order out of chaos, which is written into the beginning of the Bible. So it's this iconography which in our era has to be rethought, and that's what I've been trying to do in my own work, this content-driven work. And this, you know, with scientists and philosophers and craftsmen and others, it's not a it's a multiple voice discourse. It's a shared program. And I just show you one slide from science to show the decoding of the fact that the logarithmic scale of the density of atoms and their size creates a certain architectural coherence right up the line connecting the atom to the star off the scale in the very large relativistic world or the very small quantum world. There isn't that architectural coherence. But you could say, as a metaphor, that there is an architecture created by the universe or self-organizing architecture that is opposed, if one follows this metaphor, to building. I mean, of course, there's a lot of junk in the universe. Most of the stuff may be not very beautiful or very organized, and in that sense is junk, but even such things as junk DNA, we're finding out, are not junk. So architectural organization goes through, I would argue, through the universe, and we're working on how to make that into an iconography. So in a garden, let's talk of now, focus down on the garden. And I show you in the bird kingdom, but it's true of the animal kingdom, that there's even architecture and gardening here. The bower bird in this painting, you see the male trying to entice the female into his garden, and he's made a wattle fence around it, a thatched daub and mud twig edge to his garden wall, and he's put wonderful blue bottles, caps, and blue plastic, things he found in urban society on the inside, and made a circular cave and dressed it at the front with hanging yellow flowers and red berries, and even orange berries. So you can see the bowerbird showing off his crest or crown and enticing the female into his bower. And if he's designed a successful garden, he gets the bird. And I think that's always a good reason to design a garden, but not the only one. I start off this way because I don't think that, I mean, there's many reasons to create a garden, some of them completely having nothing to do with the points I've been making before, which is maybe the larger, more portentous reasons for designing a garden, using nature to talk about nature, to talk with nature, to understand the units of the universe. And design and iconography is one thing, but you, of course, create a garden for enjoyment and for creating with nature. And I show here these granite stones I picked up on the beach and laid out outside a greenhouse, and in a spiral, a double spiral here and a spiral up there. And I left them there, and the greenhouse window was open, and out grew a passion flower outside the window and entwined itself around my sculpture. And of course, that's what every garden designer wants, and the passion of flowers to follow the passion of what you design. And I have to say, it did it. In other words, I never designed that. And one of the enjoyments of a garden, every gardener knows this, is that, you know, you're co-creating something, and often nature does a better job than you do, and that's some of the pleasure that you happily surprise. So gardens have many motives, and there should never be one. In fact, I would argue that the multiple motives are the deep idea behind gardens. Now, one of the garden designers who lives not far from us in Scotland is Ian Hamilton Finlay, who is no longer with us, alas. He died 2 years ago. But he created this garden around many themes, the French Revolution, and criticism of contemporary society. And he made the remark that a garden is not only a retreat where you go to escape society, but it's an attack. An interesting metaphor, a garden is an attack. And he was attacking contemporary culture, among other things. And I'm not going to say too much about the way my garden is a polemic a critique of both contemporary science as metaphor and contemporary art in the guise of the man I'm showing you now, Damien Hirst, who took a 14-inch teaching model of a sectioned man, as you see on the slide here, and blew it up to about 14 feet and actually stole the design from the model maker, who later sued him successfully. And he blew it up and made it in bronze and sold it to Charles Saatchi for £1 million. Well, and called it him, H-Y-M-N, him, bad pun on him, man. But this kind of non-imaginative, reproductive, rip-off science is, to me, degraded art, and the kind of thing I think I would attack with, along with Ian Hamilton Finlay. The Garden of Cosmic Speculation is speculation with scientists and others on the units of the universe and using nature to talk with nature and relate ourselves to nature. It's in an area of Scotland with in the borders in the southwest, which is rather rolling, and it has a few passes like this, the Dalveen Pass, where in the evening, when the sun has a long raking light, it can cast the wonderful shadows and brings out a metaphor of the skin and the bones of the hills, which sheep eat, and the veins of the and arteries of the earth, where the water pours down the side of the mountains and creates the streams. And it's the Chinese who, in their gardens, celebrate these metaphors, the bones of the earth and the arteries. And they say you build a Chinese garden with rocks and water first, before you plant it. So that's a metaphor which has 2,000 years of history, and it seems to me an interesting one for thinking about gardens. And one's metaphors, of course, relate us to gardens, but they also relate us to the universe. So it's a kind of idea that I was very interested in with my late wife, Maggie, who you see or hear happily in the Vancouver garden, which she helped influence the design of. She was very interested in Chinese gardens. She dragged me around happily, China, many times. And you see her here with Joe Wei, the architect and designer of this garden. And you see her surrounded by those rocks, those peanut brittle rocks. People don't, especially the British, whose gardens are very green, and the Chinese are at kind of opposite ends of this. And the Chinese say, why do you have grass in a garden? You know, grass is for cows. The Anglo-British, as it were, think that there's too much, these gardens are too cluttered with things. But both sides, I think, when they understand the other, begin to appreciate exactly what's going on in each of them. Anyway, Maggie was started work on, it was her family garden, and then she got cancer, and she died in 1995. And we started because I knew a lot of architects very closely for 35, 40 years, and they were very good friends. I started asking them to design these cancer caring centers, which I named after her, something she wouldn't have liked, but I did because they are patient-oriented centers, and I thought they should have a patient's name. And they've been quite successful, and thanks to the architects, really. Here you see Frank Gehry talking to Piers Goff in his Frank Gehry's building inside the one in Dundee, and you see it on the right. It's your left. You see it, one part of it, looking out at night. So we have six of these up, six more are under construction, and we hope to have one at every big cancer center in Britain. And architecture has helped us, and indeed architectural metaphor has helped us, because these buildings are hybrid buildings and they're multiple metaphors. And I think the multiplicity of functions and the multiplicity of metaphors is a very happy way to fight cancer and to live in your relationship to it. Anyway, I'll take you now quickly through the garden to give you an idea of the whole. There are about 25 or 30 different parts of the garden. I don't have time to show many, but I'll run you around from the fractal terrace down here across a jumping bridge into the quantum area of the Cork Walk, and race around till we get in a circle through the Black Hole Terrace here, Symmetry Break Terrace there, and the Universe Cascade at the heart of the garden. So we'll have a quick run around so you get a feeling of what the garden is before we zero in. The deep metaphor is a landscape of waves, quantum waves, brain waves, soliton waves, water waves, air waves. Even there's a train that runs through the garden. A new part I won't be showing is a train garden of Scottish worthies designed around the Enlightenment. Anyway, there's planting waves and waveforms in multiple forms, because the idea is that the waveform in our culture has been pushed into the background against the particle form, and everything in the universe is both a wave and a particle. So this is a landscape of waves to celebrate that aspect. And you enter, one of the entrances through this terrace, the fractal terrace, focusing on one of the mounds, a double helical mound, and you see to the left it has a vernacular white rectangular wall with gray, black tiles. And that comes down, the wall comes down, it's flat, comes into the ground and curves, and then the ground comes up and slightly curves down. So the terrace is slightly bowed as a visual illusion. And the word below is here, slightly off camera, it says metamorphosis. And what the fractal tariff symbolizes is the two great arguments about what are the underlying forms of nature. In architecture and in Platonic theory, it is, of course, the regular solids, the square, cylinder, cone, spheres, the regular polyhedra, which Plato and architects for 2,000 or 3,000 years, indeed Egyptian architecture is based on those primary forms. Roman architecture is, Le Corbusier's architecture is, Cézanne even famously said everything in nature is spheres, cones, and cylinders. So the metaphysics of the West, and I even think of China to a degree, and Chinese architecture has been based on these regular solids. However, in 1977, Benoit Mandelbrot, with his computers and so on, put forward the theory of the fractal geometry of nature, and he said most of nature is fractal. And you can see then the squares and rectangles morphing into squares, squares into rhomboids, rhomboids into irregular shapes, into fractured shapes, those into self-similar shapes going into the ground at many scales and then emerging here as teeth. As the word metamorphosis morphoses itself into a fractal set of letters. And so the idea behind the fractal tariff is that both theories of what are the ultimate forms of the universe are, what is this, the language of nature, is shown here without a position being taken. In other words, they morph. It morphs, it metamorphs from one theory to the other in front of us. You walk around in the way I've just shown you, going across the jumping bridge, which jumps across two streams, a kind of fractal bridge, and you come to the Quark Walk by a bend in the river. This, by the way, is the recent bridge, train bridge that's going in. And the Quark Walk is shown in these eight elements of the Eightfold Way of the man who formulated quarks, Murray Gell-Mann. And if you know about quarks, the quarks are the ultimate particles of the universe, the things behind, underneath the atom, the proton, the neutron. And when the way they measure them or try to look at them, they can't see them directly, is through these incredible explosions where you send a proton and an antiproton, you speed them up to almost the speed of light, and then they hit an explosion, which you see on your left. Or actually, you see it in left and right. The left, you see the photograph in CERN, and in the right, you see my version in three dimensions over the water. Reflected in the water, you see the flat reflection like a photograph, and you see what it is in three dimensions. That is, it's a spin of all these little elements in the explosion. Thousands and thousands, millions of elements come out, and they photograph as many as they can. At CERN, you know, they're about to turn on the accelerator again and see if they can find the missing Higgs particle. So this is a beautiful language of nature in these spins, in these, you know, quarks or ultimate particles. And I thought a place in the garden should show that. And so over the water and in other parts, that's what I did. You can see the quark, the Eightfold Way there, and a seat which has the standard model of the quarks behind it. Go further around, you see an aerial view of the black hole terrace we eat on. When Maggie and I used to eat outside, we'd sink into the ground after about a half an hour because it's so wet. So we needed a terrace to eat on. And after she died, he built this one where you're pulled into it by real gravity. You fall in. It's tilted in two dimensions, and you're pulled in by real gravity, and gravity creates black holes, it's supergravity, and they warp space and time, and a language of form comes out of that, which I really don't have time to explain, but you can get the feeling of how space and time are warped according to Einstein's theory. And then you circle around, you peel back the onion, and it focuses on the universe cascade, which I'll discuss in conclusion. But you see a glimpse there. Now, my argument is that what I'm doing here is a traditional way of design, in the sense that this garden, Pleasance in Scotland, called Edsel Garden, for a family enclosure, has a lot of symbolism to do with what was thought to be the underlying explanation of the universe and the sciences at that time. Just one example of that is this statue in the wall here above some planting of geometria, a woman. Actually, she's also called Architectura. She's the woman of architecture, because architecture was always symbolized as a woman, with her sleeves rolled up, strong woman. She could go out in the building site and talk to buildings and, you know, construction laborers who are always swearing and being disagreeable. And she has, like that painting of God, she has the architectural instrument in her hand, and she's laying out her buildings and her universe in a geometric way. So the planting there, the words in the planting, the epigraphy, the symbols of the colors that are planted there, the colors of the wall, all of that relate to the family and to what the designer in this family was trying to symbolize. That was a normal thing to do in garden art from the time of the Egyptians, if you look at Egyptian gardens, right through history. So, right through Chinese gardens too. It's a very traditional idea. What would it be today? The argument, the question is really, what would it be today if we tried to do the same thing, knowing what we know about our universe and relating us to that? So Gaia, for instance, one of the places in the garden, has a monument to, or at least a sculpture of an interpretation of Gaia, put forward by, of course, one of its inventors, James Lovelock. And he says that Gaia, of course, which is again a metaphor of the Earth as a self-organizing system, the mother goddess Gaia, is a tight coupling between the chemical elements, the material elements, and life. They couple. He even uses a sexual metaphor of tight coupling here, tightly interacting, so in such a way that it balances the atmosphere at exactly the right relationships of the gases. It pumps down the CO2, or it has for, let us say, 2 billion years, pumped it right down, pumped up the oxygen, balanced the nitrogen, and so forth. In other words, running off the sun's energy, which is symbolized by the supports, the sun, you can see 4.5 billion years of evolution here with the present-day Earth there, and the tight coupling of those elements. So that the Earth, as a self-organizing, creative, dynamic, moving element, alive, as it were, like Gaia, like a goddess, is something that sustains the relationship of the gases, and importantly, at oxygen at around 21%, so it doesn't go too low to 15%, so we gasp, or too high to 25%, so we all burn up. Extraordinary that it can balance it and regulate it in it, fine-tune it for so many years. This is an event, a long-term event, which is worthy of celebration in a garden and becoming an icon, as it were, instead of, let's say, just a gherkin. Waveforms. Soliton waves. A normal wave, like a whiplash, is like that. But a soliton wave is a trapped twist. And the only way you can get rid of a soliton wave is by an anti-twist. A soliton wave is a kind of coherent energy packet, like a tsunami, which can travel all across the oceans, as we know, or at least a long way, and create havoc. A tidal wave, a tidal boar. It was discovered when a man in Edinburgh was on a horse and he followed a tidal boar for 8 miles up a river, and it just a coherent packet of water, just going on and on and on. He ran out of, I mean, his horse couldn't follow it more than 8 miles. Soliton waves can go through each other like that, keeping a memory of each other, of themselves as they go through, whereas normal waves cancel and wipe out. So I wanted to have a lot of soliton waves in the garden because soliton waves have this memory related to plasma physics in our brain. And you'll find a lot of soliton waves in this garden. There are about 15 soliton gates where the waveform comes through up from the from the hinge to the latch, showing you how to open the gate. So it serves a kind of function. And it's a trap twist where it's the void you read here in the snow as a positive figure that seems to have a kind of energy. It's, in a way, you know, I mean, it's, here is the waveform. It's because it's electromagnetic waves that you're seeing and their absence, which is making the figure run through both the collage and the gates. Waves, real water waves here come in across from one mound to another, just a puff of air comes across the water and creates, like a thought, something that lasts for maybe 3 or 4 seconds, a metaphor which poets have used. So many different kinds of waves in this landscape of waves. These go from to the right, to the left, from the place where you swim to a self-similar set of curves to the cows out here. And each one is slightly different, but similar to the previous one. You're looking down there from the double helical mound across to another undulating mound, which twists towards the cows one way and towards the water the other. And it's the paths cut with a sharp edge seen in the raking light, which I've used here to bring out the qualities of a mound, something that I'm convinced the early First Native Americans and also First Nation Canadian Indians who also created these kind of mounds were aware of. I'm completely convinced of that because when you see these, when you walk among these kinds of mounds, they have a kind of immediate haptic quality, physical quality. And we know they created many snake mounds and undulating mounds, which related to the animal kingdom. Different views of those curves, self-similar curves, looking back at the double helix. And you can see how it is the raking light in the evening, in this case, which suddenly lifts the ground, the pathway, and it becomes bright as against the shadow. It seems almost like the metaphor of Mother Earth. As I've mentioned, waveforms are everywhere. There's the Simplon Pass here. So the ductile waves of, you know, rocks and mountains in Switzerland, the river delta. You're on a river delta, I guess, here in Vancouver. If you drag a stick through black oil, you create these turbulent waves, which you can see versions of in Jupiter. And, of course, weather waves. Every day's weather map, which you see here coming in England. We talk about the weather, I guess, as you do in Vancouver. I've used waves in other work in mounds, and I built this wave based on a strange attractor. It's called the Ueda attractor after a Japanese scientist who named it, gave it his name, and it shows the kind of ductility which the Earth has when you move Earth around, and it has a kind of stickiness, if it's the right consistency, and it creates its own language. Here is the Ueda attractor here, and you can see attractor basins forming, which I've picked up in little curves in the two attractor basins of this rather S-curve version of it. You enter through here, you come down a ramp and some steps here where you can sit outside the Gallery of Modern Art in Edinburgh. There's another gallery across the street. And functionally, the landform is meant to block off this entry road here, which is heavily trafficked for people visiting the gallery. So it serves as a lot of earth berms, the function of screening a nice area to sit in and have a picnic. When I designed it, I imagined it being used as an outdoor gallery with sculpture on several levels. So you could see, you'd have a retrospective of a sculptor, and it'd be great to see a David Smith sculpture along it from above, around the side, and from below, and you could walk around and interact. Unfortunately, the gallery takes a more kind of purified view of the landform, and they haven't used it this way, but it is used for celebrations and as a social place of meeting at various times of year. And when it first opened, I saw that children particularly love it. You can see them being chased by their father across here, trying to catch them. So much do the children love it is that they have to repair the turf every 4 months. In other words, it's used to destruction. You enter through this river picked rock that I found in our local river, and it has the same S-curve. So the ornament and the of the shapes in cut in the aluminium and the word Festina Lente and the inner planets and the sun, all of that is meant to be decoded or read if you care to. If you don't want to know about what a strange attractor is, if you don't care about that sort of thing, that's fine too, because of course a garden should be experienced inattentively without knowing, sort of as pure pleasure. But the Renaissance used the phrase in their gardens, Festina Lente, meaning make haste to go slow. And they used it for the reasons that a garden should slow you down. A garden shouldn't be a place where you drive through quickly from one end in and out. And it should, they found, I mean, their argument was, and I think it's quite true, that symbolism as well as sculpture and art slows you down to wonder about it, to hunt the symbol, to decode it. And in this case, it serves another function because there are 13 manholes in the garden. Because in any urban garden, of course, it's the underground spaghetti and water and sewers and pipes and everything that have to be serviced. So here, it becomes the focus of the strange attractor basin, which is the sun and the earth and the inner planets and the wobble of the galaxy and so forth. In other words, there's an attempt to use function and use and words to send a complex message. Now, land art and art outside the gallery started to raise the question in the 60s, what is happening? And it was Rosalind Krauss who, in this famous diagram, used a Boolean logic to say what's happening with sculpture is that if you look at the work of Mary Miss and Richard Serra and many of the contemporary land artists, above all Robert Smithson, you find it's really not sculpture. And it's not architecture either, and it's not landscape. So she used a kind of a not logic to argue what it was not, and said, if you rotate the knots, they come up with marked sites, site construction, axiomatic structures. This is a very important theoretical article called Sculpture in the Expanded Field to try to explain to curators and artists what was really happening. And I think it was it's the most quoted single analysis of contemporary not sculpture. To me, it was very revealing, except that it overemphasized the negative logic. And in my own work, it's the content, and it's not urbanism and landscape. It's combining all of those things that's the important aspect. In other words, it's a very hybrid practice that interests me in landforming. It's the fact that traditionally landforms such as Stonehenge and others have had content-driven ideas as well as combined architecture, festivities, landscape, gardens, and sculpture, and even, in, to a certain extent, infrastructure, because Stonehenge is part of a ritual landscape. So my work is content-driven, and it's between the categories. So I'll quickly just show some other work without explaining much of it, except to say that it is all based around narratives and ideas that are multiply coded. In this park in Italy, Parco Portello, northwest Italy, Milan, you can see prehistory, history, and the present symbolized in parts of it. And to the north, which I'll show you in a second, this time garden, there's a view of it under construction in a highly urban area. And the double helical mound now with a DNA on it. It's about 80 or 90% finished now. The time walk, where it's the planting and the walk itself which interact, showing the ritmo del tempo, the rhythms of time, the planting of the four seasons with different plants and different periods of our life, as well as the walking through 1 year. There's 182 and a half steps that way, 365 when you walk back that way, as well as the monthly cycles, and about 20 or so rhythms of time, of planting time, walking time, and contemplative time. So built into the garden then is this kind of symbolism that you decode and you experience through all the senses of smell and sight, perfume and sounds, as well as detailed flat sculpture. There's the 91st day of the year and the tilt of the axis, which gives the seasons as well as the months of the year, as well as places to sit in and amongst the plants of that season. One more thing of that. And it's just to the south of a hospital, and I wanted to put in, of course, the rhythm that was most key to all of our lives, and that is our heartbeat. So I took in the stones you can see part of the cardiac rhythm there represented. So as you walk, you're aware of the pounding. Something that, by the way, the client didn't like. As an older man, he didn't like me, remind me. Tried to censor. Another scheme, which was more political, was this created after 2003, when the French Chaumont garden scheme came to me and said, would you design a keynote garden for the Chaumont Festival of 2004, based on, they'd seen the garden I was doing on complexity and chaos theory, and they said, this year's theme is chaos theory. And they said, would you do a chaotic garden, a water garden, a chaotic water garden? So I thought for a while, and I thought, what is the most chaotic thing that we have in our culture? And what's happening? And of course, what was happening was George Bush. And so naturally, thinking of the metaphor there, didn't have to think very hard about his name, and the invasion, and I was, part of an architectural group which was against the invasion of Iraq. I created this war garden, a water war garden, called the Curse of Agamemnon. The curse, of course, being that, as Churchill had said, war is a perennial occupation of man, the human. And this is a water war garden, which, based on strange attractors and other elements of war and water, you enter through the the barrel of a gun, of a big Chinese garden gun here, you'll see, and Moon Gate with the gun sight, and you walk around this strange attractor, and it focuses your eye on some water pulse, that is, catapults of water that are throwing water at each other, tit for tat, in an endless cycle of war, which war is, tit for tat often, and the more water that they throw at each other, the more the plants grow here, because it waters what the flowers. While in the background, you can see the five major superpowers here, with America at the center, and on the right wing is, if I can remember, is England, sorry, Britain. It's France, so it's Grande-Bretagne, and Espagne. Who was, Allemagne, and on the left wing, France, and I can't remember who the other part of the major superpowers was. But anyway, they're all shooting water at these satellites, which are coffin-like tubs with plastic flowers on them. And they're shooting water with these cannons. This is an interactive garden, by the way. And again, it was loved by children so much that they had to repair it every week. It was loved to death. As the children come in and shoot at these little boats with plastic flowers. And they were marked Iran, Iraq, and all of Middle East countries. And they had to shoot them and push them into their harbor. And so they would, two or three superpowers would push them into their harbor, and then another one would float free, and then they'd have to aim together and push that in the harbor, and then another one would float free. So it's exactly what's happening, you know. We shoot them, and then they come out, and then we shoot another one, and they come out. Very predictive of Afghanistan. Anyway, a chaotic water wheel here, you'll see in a second, and that drops water down here in these cannon that go up and down. The water comes through, and they make not a beautiful noise, as in a Japanese garden with the things that go up and down, but a bang, 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 bang. So a kind of machine gun of noise. That's looking through the barrel of a gun at the chaotic water wheel, which, as it goes around asymmetrically, it pulsates, it explodes at you, and you see moving into the planting and the wonderful green algae and some beautiful plants too, and pondweed. You can see the catapults back there, Israel and Palestine shooting at each other, throwing water at each other. There they go, boom, tit for tat. And all the while, the things are growing. Where they're in the background, you see them firing the water at those boats, Iran. And there's a water wheel you can't see move, but it does. There's the up and down machine guns of the water falling down as they go up and down. And in that corner, everything was stenciled so that you could read where you were in the world. And it ends with the petite bush and prickly bush. So I planted all of the bushes in that part of the... Another scheme, and completely different, hasn't started, and it may not be built, but it's in by the Polish border in East Germany, what was East Germany, in a very poor area, impoverished area, where many, 20% unemployment, many people leave. It's an area where, in the end of the communist empire, there were these great machines which were a half a mile long, eating up brown coal out of the ground. They moved forward at about this speed, manned by four men. And it's so big, these machines. And, I mean, they look out of like something out of James Bond. I don't know why they don't make a film there. They made nine of them, and then communism collapsed. Three are left, still moving and eating up. And what they eat up are villages. So I was asked to come in and give back identity to this town, Altobern, which is the center of this whole 5,000 square kilometers of Eton villages, to give back identity and memory to a culture where literally their towns had been destroyed and people had been kicked out, and then the brown coal dug out. So it was a project of identity, of memory, and I thought, what can one give in this huge landscape that in the center of it? There are many other schemes, by the way, many landscape schemes, maybe 20. And it occurred to me that what they were doing was incredible, that they were creating, first of all, there you see the one that I'm involved with. The town, Altobern, is here. And this is when they're re-flooding what they dug out to create these amazing lakes. And so I drew a quick sketch of the Lake District of Milan, the great Italian lakes, and then in Britain, the Lake District, which is, of course, in a way, the center of where everybody wants to get in the summer and indeed retire to, the Lake District, the beautiful Lake District of Britain. And I realized that this area was going to create where there were maybe 10 or so lakes, major lakes in Britain, and the same amount in Italy. It was going to create 40 lakes. So there was going to be the biggest lake district and artificial lake district in the world. And this was an incredible project, a very utopian project. So I thought, how can one symbolize a future? And I called the project The Memories of the Future, with the idea that if they could keep a memory of their possible future for 25 years and carry out the program that they were at least verbally committed to, that they would have the greatest lake district in the world. They used to be connected. Their sister city was here, and the lake has now come between them. So you have to go something like 17 kilometers to get to their sister city, which they used to be about a kilometer and a half from. So our project is a giant clasping hand which embraces a garden and gestures to the boats that will pass to and fro across this new lake. There you see it from the air with parts to land on by boat. And it cups a garden. And the garden you see here also in a quick model is made up of a plan of the area of the 5,000 square kilometers. That is to say, the roads, highways, the railroads, and the towns, each one of which is given a hand or a landform to surround it, and an example of what is actually being created in the other lake areas, so that the memory of the future will be in the center of this whole 5,000 square kilometers, will be a map, a garden map of the waterways, the river that comes down from Berlin, the highway, the railroads, and then these major cities as places to sit and enjoy a garden-like atmosphere. So, in other words, the content-driven, this content-driven work came from the idea of giving back identity to a place that had been basically deracinated and uprooted. Now, returning to the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, one of the great discoveries of our time is, of course, the gene and the genetic structure, the double helix. And I combined it in this part of the garden with the senses. And so you see in this flying cosmic airplane of a garden, the plan of the six senses. You see an ear flying by here. You see some noses and other senses. And you see the layout of the garden, the six different quadrants. And you see the fact that each one has a spiral or helix at its double helix at its center, and one of the six senses. In fact, of course, we know the five senses. The five senses were named by Aristotle. The sixth sense is the female sense of intuition or anticipation. But in fact, we have something like 12 or 14 senses if you talk to scientists. So there are many senses, the kinesthetic sense, for instance, the sense of balance. There are many senses, and it's, a garden is a sensorium where you experience your senses heightened. And I thought the senses and DNA should be then two metaphors underlined this part. And around each cell is a cell wall, a membrane here in box hedges, and the DNA is read by the RNA, and the RNA comes out, is read by the ribosomes and as RNA. So the whole program of the genetics became the layout of the garden, including the double helix. And all of that, in a sense, an attack on the notion of the selfish gene, the reigning gene theory in Britain of the last 32 years, ever since Richard Dawkins' bestseller book, known as The Selfish Gene. It has been the major metaphor of, you know, how we think of those 20,000 genes in our bodies, a kind of very malignant metaphor as far as I'm concerned, but one that has nevertheless caught on in the literary world, in the philosophical world, and the world of how we experience, you know, what are those underlying aspects of ourselves. Very disturbing. Richard Dawkins, the scientist in charge of the public understanding of science, telling us that we are robot vehicles, these are his words, for these these little parts that influence how we live. We're the robot vehicle, and they are the final deciders of our future. You know, completely modernist reductivist theory, and a highly questionable one, for all sorts of reasons which have been pointed out by other scientists, other biologists, but nevertheless a metaphor which has caught on and which a lot of people have seen as their self-image. I say that because if it is true that genes are very important and, as it were, the atoms of all of us, of all life, as far as we know, then they ought to be celebrated in the garden. And the fact that they have a beautiful structure is of course, a great plus. So how does one convey that beauty, that importance, that ugliness, all of those complex ideas that are the truth of DNA? The ugliness is that most of the times it's supercoiled and looks like spaghetti, a mess, all right? So, you know, it's wrestling with those questions, and also, of course, wrestling with the way it's taught in a class of science and a stick and ball model, and realizing that any representation of reality, of ultimate reality, is an abstraction, is a cut through how you can represent it. You can represent it in its beautiful form, you can represent it, you know, in a molecular form, and you can represent it as the most important atom of living tissue, common to everything alive on Earth, as far as we know. So it struck me that it was a time to celebrate DNA as well as criticize these theories of selfish gene. And I can't go into the whole criticism of that, but for one thing, cells communicate with each other at points, and it's that communication which is just as important as any communication between DNAs and other DNAs and regulatory DNAs. So if you get into DNA, you begin to understand that it would have been just as relevant to call it the altruistic gene as the selfish gene, because it's only really altruistic genes that survive in our 20,000 genomes as selfish ones. So it's kind of complete mistake to call it selfish gene, and yet it has been the bestseller for 32 years, and what does that say about us? Why? When I said it to my son, he said, you wouldn't have sold any books if you call it the altruistic gene. Something to think about. Um, So DNA shown in its ugly state here, supercoiled above the hand, waving in the breeze, sense of touch, while nasty things to touch, thistles, nettles, thorns, the kind of things that gardeners try to keep out of the garden is nettles. You know, they run away and strike you and hurt you. But they increase your sensitivity to touch, right? And around the back of this are dockweed and lamb's ear and nice things to touch. So the hand waves in the breeze and you feel, yes, touch is what a garden is about, partly. Or taste wild strawberries under these lips, DNA super uncoiling above. You go inside a DNA, here is a little crypt, and you see these optical tricks and things, op art kind of things. So sight, smell, you step on herbs and you release smell above these nose. As you go down to the nose to smell it, it smells horrible, but you release nice smells at the time. So each one of the centers of the cell has another thing that heightens your senses. Sense of hearing has a rotating in the wind parabola, which you can speak into, and it broadcasts your sound across the garden. Or in the wind also, this ear rotates. When it rotates in the wind, it creates chimes. I mean, they chime, so it creates a kind of noise, not really music. And all of that is in a white or silver environment of oak and aluminium and anaphylis growing below it. So it's a mixture of growing things, you know, oak that's going silver and metal. Finally, the sixth sense in the largest DNA uncoiling there, which is this growing in this plant, Love in a Mist, which vibrates in the wind. It's very sensitive to the wind. And it has, you see, little fingers coming out here. When I asked Maggie what the sixth sense was, she put her fingers in the air and she said, it's a sense of feeling without knowing why. You're anticipating something, thinking something. You feel something first and you think of it later. And so I've represented anticipation by those fingers, and they're connected to little neurons that go into the brain, and the brain bounces up and down here in a car spring while the mind looks at the brain just as a percept does, because when you have a perception, of course, it comes through one of your senses, but you don't know if it's false, you don't know if it's a lie, you don't know if it's an illusion. So you have to talk to your brain, and if your brain says, hey, there's something going on, your mind says, no, that's not going on. That's a mistake. So any percept is a mixture, and you bounce along there in the breeze, thinking of that interaction. So when I did that, my old teacher, who was a scientist, Gerald Holden, said to me, you know, Einstein said, the most important thing for science is Fingerspitzengefühle. I didn't speak any German. And he said, it means a sense in the end of the fingertips, a feeling at the end of the sense at the end of your fingertips of what's going to happen next. He said, a good scientist has to have that. It was really very nice that that's a scientific metaphor. That's looking down at the six of the cells and focus there on the sixth sense. One of the great ideas of our time is symmetry breaking, and a recent idea. You know, in architecture, we talk about symmetry all the time. We have since Vitruvius, if not before, and we think of everything as symmetry making. But scientists have shown, at a certain level, the universe can be considered, the history of the universe can be considered a breaking in supersymmetry. In other words, it starts off as a completely unified whole, and then for the next 13 billion years, it's the breaking of symmetry which creates the interest. So suddenly, you can see how important for architecture this is. It's symmetry breaking as well as symmetry making, and the two are very related. So if you look at this symmetry sign here in stone, and you stood on your head, or turn your head sideways, you can see it says symmetry upside down. So it's a break in symmetry, positive, negative, and negative, positive, which reads the same way both ways. interesting fact that you can use. You can break the symmetry of words in a way that you can break the symmetry of form. And the symmetry break terrace shows the universe in four basic jumps from the energy, the early energy, coming out of the first microsecond, creation, and then cooling, suddenly the universe jumps into matter, energy into matter, matter into life, life into consciousness. And so those four jumps here, you can see energy, matter, life, consciousness. The history, the basic symmetry breaks in universal development. So the center of the garden of cosmic speculation, then you come around it, and it focuses across the DNA garden here on this universe cascade. And as you can see from this plan, you can't get to it. Like an Italian garden, go down, shouldn't it? And so you should end. And I said, but you can't have the universe end in the ground, because where could you go? You couldn't burrow in the ground. It has to go up. So anyway, you can see what kind of, where symbolism gets you sometimes. Anyway, it also gets you in a very positive place in design terms. If you're willing to listen to what scientists are saying, what nature is saying, after I had been designing this, the pond froze, and the theory of membrane universes was put forward. And so I thought, my golly, you see, that the... you know, the ice was like a membrane. I had done the membranes here, and then it froze, and it sort of underscored both the theory of membranes and the membranes I designed. So every now and then, nature confirms science and confirms garden design. But it's the interaction which is a great pleasure, to work with scientists and to work with this unfolding narrative and to criticize it, to attack it, to design everything twice, both for functional reasons and for metaphorical reasons, to question the Big Bang. It wasn't big, wasn't a bang, no one heard it. It was a hot stretch of space. And yet, scientists will use the word Big Bang unselfconsciously, even knowing when you question them that it wasn't. You know, its bangedness was really Pentagon language and not a truth, a deep truth of the origin of the universe, is that it starts smaller than a quark and expands faster than the speed of light, reconciling the kinetic force and the explosive force and the contractual force. So there are deep metaphors here which are waiting to become the icons of a new iconography. That's the argument. And one has to be critical. One has to enjoy it. And it, I must say, the enjoyment has been the great thing in being able to do this over 15 years, the early part with my late wife, Maggie, and working with nature, and sometimes nature, of course, producing much better versions of whatever one could design, as in the fall and the autumn, where you just get a glimpse of the tree colors that all of a sudden all the symbolism turns red, and the whole thing looks completely different in different seasons. Can turn white. All the mistakes are sort of covered by this nice snow. Catastrophes in the garden. I mean, every gardener knows that half the things you plant die. So, of course, a garden is an arbitrary, artificial, artistic creation. We all dream of the perfect ecological garden, which you just do, and it, like Eden, it never needs looking after. Everything is perfect. And there are moments when that even happens and you didn't intend it. So that's nice. But I think working with nature, using the languages of nature to talk about nature is the pleasure which every gardener really knows and has known for a long time. And I end with those ideas and this plan of part of the garden. And I was explaining these multiple meanings to a critic who came through the garden. Garden historian, and he didn't understand any science, and he said, I can't understand a word you're saying. And but I did understand one thing, and I said, what was that? And he said, I understood that everything has many meanings. Yes, I said. And what did you think of that? And he said, well, here's the plan. You obviously thought a long time about how this is a plan of Margaret Thatcher, and Here's her mouth and her nose. It's a little bit off camera, but her nose was there. Her eyes are there. Her cheek is there. Her hair is there. Her twin set is there. It was a perfect portrait of Margaret Thatcher in her one of her more attack modes. So the idea is basically of that in a cosmogenic art is that the universe is not full of selfish genes and big bangs. It's not a reductive place. Fundamentally, what postmodern scientists like Philip Anderson, the Nobel laureate, have said, it's not less is more. The universe, it's more is different. If you add anything into the universe, more energy, more matter, more information, more culture, more life, it organizes, self-organizes in a different way. More is different. And it's a very benign, in many ways, benign universe. It's a dangerous universe. It's full of terror. It's full of hardship. It's full of suffering. It's full of death. But on balance, it's an incredibly dynamic, self-organizing, creative event. And the garden, I think, is the place to celebrate it. Thank you.
We will take questions for a few minutes, and then there will be coffee and cookies outside. This lecture is being taped and the question period, so if you do leave, I would ask you to do so as quietly as possible so that we can continue to do the recording. So let's take some questions. Eric.
Yes. Are you worried at all that the icons of science may change rather rapidly because Newton's clockwork universe would have lasted the images for 300 years. But that we heard last week that in particle physics, we're trying to overthrow that very successful standard model and its eightfold way and find new models. So your icon may change.
Question is whether, am I worried about the change in science and therefore the change in the icons, and the icons will be rendered obsolete very quickly or slowly. Like the Newtonian icons have been partly rendered obsolete. Yes, of course, you're absolutely right, and that is a problem. And I think if you take a positive view of the problem, you say, well, at least all the mistakes will clearly date the garden to the time when that silly theory was thought. I agree, it is a problem. But the thing about the collective thing about science is that it is the longest unbroken meditation, and there is a lot of truth that still gets through. So I, you know, in a sense, Newton, there's still a lot of truth to Newton, even though there's some problems. Yeah. Well, okay, simulation and reality. We know, of course, that there is a relation between simulation and reality, and it can be used, simulation can be used to lie, and it is often in the world of advertisement, no question. We live in a world where branding has taken precedence over, if you like, reality, and that's very true in the art world. What can we do? Well, we can criticize, we can make humorous attacks on the situation of art, and even Damien Hirst himself, who is one of the most unconscionable cynics of art, who nevertheless produces every 20th work of great interest and power. The other 19 are really retrograde, like Jeff Koons is also retrograde. So I agree with your basic point. What are we doing in a world of simulation, where simulation seems to be winning? How do we criticize it? Actually, Damien Hirst is now producing a film which is showing how much he lies, and he's selling the film for a lot of money. What can we do? I think all we can do is keep trying to be funnier than they are.
Since what you have created for yourself appears to be the iconic garden, and you ended your talk by saying that more is different, what changes do you envision for your garden, especially as it may or perhaps not transition from a private domain into the public realm?
Well, first of all, it belongs to my son, so it's not my call. It's his call, and we open once a year publicly, but we're open any time to anyone who writes. And I think it would be destroyed if, it was open on an impulse basis. It has, by its nature, you can't have a lot of people coming to a very wet climate, trudging over those mounds, or they'd be mud pies, and people would slip and not enjoy it. So it has a kind of inherent limitation. It is changing, actually, a lot more. Has happened since in the last 4 or 5 years since the book's come out. And I have this Garden of Scottish Worthies. There are other developments. I'm doing a Garden of Life and Death out of bones and doing some other things. And it will develop. My son will develop it. My daughter, who also is involved in it, will do some work in it. And I hope, like all gardens, it's never finished. I'm sure it won't be finished. And as it as certain catastrophes happen, I don't know if you enjoy catastrophe theory, but there is a whole theory of catastrophe. And when a certain thing, in catastrophe theory, mudslides are very big. In figuring out catastrophe theory, it was, you may know this, sand pile theory, like earthquakes, basically. And they can produce a new kind of ornament. They can. So I think, you make a move and I make a move and then you make a move and I make a move. Nature and it's always a dialogue. I think that metaphor, which is one of the scientists, Prigogine, said the dialogue with nature is really what science is and what art is. And I think that's a deep metaphor.
How big is your garden?
How big is the garden? The garden is 32 acres, supposedly. I don't know how big it is, but that's what they tell me. It's hard to say how big it is, especially if you borrow the landscape of other people.
Vancouver has gone pretty vertical. That's not a surprise. Other cities do too. But our private gardens, at least, are disappearing. Have you dealt with any of the sort of vertical space that we live in and are all private? We don't have
32
acres
each. We have a little, I don't know if you heard that, but in Vancouver, vertical city, not 32 acres for gardens. I myself have not, but you probably know of the Patrick Blanc, the French movement of vertical gardens, the way, of course, modernists like Le Corbusier had said, and it remains a truth, that the tops of buildings really could be used much more than they are. Living in London as I do, I'm amazed you look out of acres and acres of horrible rooftops much of which is flat. And I know it's expensive to keep a garden going, but it can also pay off if you do it well. So I see no reason that the greening of the city can't go on apace, and I think will happen. Question is the episodic nature of the garden a critique of the one-liners of the iconic building, or is it just something that developed over time? Well, it's both, actually. It is a fact that it was, we didn't have a completely worked out plan at the beginning, and it is, in a way, a coherent program of ideas, but developed opportunistically. In the sense that when the coal trains had vibrated the bridge too much, then the network rail, the network rail authority of Britain came in and said, we have to condemn your railroad bridge. And that led to me saying, well, if you'd let me design the bridge, I'd be happy to let you have the land. And so we have a new railroad garden there. And that was completely episodically developed, and the program was, because it was a train garden, became the Garden of Scottish Worthies and the Enlightenment of Scotland, because it's in Scotland, and so completely different, non-cosmic, in a sense, a non-cosmic theme. But I keep commitment to developing a certain programmatic coherence of cosmic and natural ideas, along with certain other ones. So, and I don't think a garden should be too over-unified. My hope is that, you know, my son and daughter will carry it forward and carry it. We've talked about this together. The kind of way that, you know, and as in so many traditional 18th century gardens, there is a route you could follow. And you, if you want to follow the route, you could get a coherent pattern out of it. But actually, as you know, in any garden, there's forked paths, and you can go any which way. So that it ought to have I call it a five-hour route, if you're a mad garden enthusiast, and there are a lot of those around, or you're just there for 15 minutes, you know. There's many ways to experience it, and the garden ought to be able to accommodate both. The question is, does the site affect the outcome? Yes, in many, many ways. Of course, in the orientation to the sun and the sunrise and how it goes around the site was absolutely key to several installations and remains so. I oriented, for cosmic reasons, I oriented a lot of elements just due north. For Scottish reasons, because in the myth of Scotland, both for the Romans and the later Scotty tribe, it was always, go north, young man, go north, because they came from Ireland and they came from Spain, you know, you go north as far as you can go north and you get to Scotland, and then if you go any further north, you fall into the Arctic Circle. So Scotland was as far north as you could go, and so the North Arrow is another orientation point. But you have to work very closely with an as-found nature of the site, and I would say all the digging of the lakes and all the mounds and any bit major earthworks are extremely pragmatically driven. And that's where I referred to designing everything two or three times. For instance, the terrace for dining was designed first as a terrace and only secondarily as a black hole and supergravity. And, you know, it's designed more than twice, but you have to work out the functions first and get the thing to work and to get it inexpensive and all the other things. And what it's used for, what it's using for eating on, so terrace where you don't sink into the earth. All of that came first, but then the program of the black hole had to use gravity, and gravity, you know, literally pulls you in, and so that's hence the tilt in the surface and the warping of space-time. So it's double design or triple design. You have to do, you know, you work on both levels, and you have to criticize the word black hole, because after all, as we're beginning to understand, there's a black hole at the center of every galaxy, and actually its blackness and wholeness isn't the most important thing. So you have to think, you know, well, what's wrong with that? What should it be? And so it's really triple design. I didn't answer your question, but I used it.
To thank our speaker, I'm going to call upon Quentin Kronk. Quentin is a professor of plant science and the former director of the UBC Botanical Garden.
To thank our speaker, I will be very brief, so that we can all get home and continue the discussion of the issues he raises. I will, however, say one thing, and that is that earlier this year, a scientific meeting took me to Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories in New York, which is the birthplace of modern molecular biology, where scientists met in the last century to unravel the secret of life. And there, as maybe even a centerpiece of the laboratory grounds, is a copy of one of the iterations of Charles Jenks's iconic, if I dare use the word, unraveling helices of DNA. And it struck me, seeing that and talking to scientists there at Cold Spring Harbor about it, the enormous affection the scientists, some of whom had been involved in discovering the structure of DNA, held for that particular sculpture. And I think it's a very good indication of the really remarkable way in which Charles Jenks is pulling together the two cultures. So for sharing his vision with us tonight, I would like to ask you to join me in thanking the speaker.
Thank you. Very kind of you to say that.
Thank you very much.
That was a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.